Greetings, everyone. This is my third talk on the new book by our founder, Dhyanam Katagiri Roshi. The title of the book is The Light That Shines Through Infinity, Zen and the Energy of Life. Today we're looking at part two of the book, Practice and Enlightenment. I want to start by talking about the quote from Katagiri Roshi that's on the printed program. So let me read the quote. Whatever activity you do, you can open your life and fit into the rhythm of this very moment. When you fit into the rhythm of the great energy of being, you feel relief. You realize that you are allowed to live. You are permitted to exist in this world because the whole world is blooming within your human body. At that time, you become you as you really are. Then you can stand up there and take care of everyday life as it really is. I especially appreciate Katagiri Roshi's use of the word relief to present enlightenment. For me, just meeting Katagiri was a relief. He interacted with people in a way that I had never seen before. Maybe it was partly because he was Japanese, but I don't think that was all of it. It seems to me that the opportunity to see or be seen at a deeper level is a rare thing. In my experience, Katagiri interacted with his students as if he saw and honored what was deep and profound in us. No matter how unhappy or confused we were on the surface of our lives. Just receiving that initial acknowledgement was a relief for me. It gave me hope about my life at a time when I really needed it. In part one of this book, there is a chapter called The Five Stages of Learning. It's kind of a loose depiction of Dongshan's five ranks, an important Chinese way of describing the process of spiritual enlightenment from the first thought of enlightenment to the final stage of realization. The first stage is having an intuitive feeling that there is something more to life, something deeper than what you have known. That awareness is a turning point in your life called awakening the way-seeking mind. From my point of view, each of us here today has that mind. It's what brings us together as a Sangha. I think that just having that mind is a kind of enlightenment, because it comes to us as a message from our original nature. If we think of enlightenment as something we want to attain or strive for, someone might jump up and say, no. You're thinking dualistically. That's your whole problem in the first place. But that doesn't mean it's wrong. To desire or seek enlightenment or to want relief from suffering, it just means let's look at it in a different way. In terms of universal energy flow, we already exist as the embodied phase of Buddha. We have been given to the light, like the Spanish words for birth, dar a luz. That is our original enlightenment. What we're seeking now is personal awareness of it. We can become aware of enlightenment because we already are enlightened, even though the veil of human consciousness has covered up our original nature. Our original nature is still always there. So why do we look for it? We look for it because we need to find a foundation to our lives that we can trust. But enlightenment isn't an experience that happens to the self-centered you that is looking for it. So the real purpose of practice isn't to get something to happen. It's to get out of the way and let something happen. It's to create a situation that allows the who that you really are and the reality that you really live in to appear in your awareness. So a lot of what we're doing when we practice is training our minds to work in a different way. You may think that you aren't good at Zazen, because when you try to concentrate your mind is always wandering off. But what really counts is gently bringing it back. Letting go of your thoughts, feelings, and perceptions creates a little space where something you don't know can arise. By doing this, you are training your mind in a skill that is essential to entering the deeper levels of your being. In this sense of practice, we are training our body and mind to work in a way that creates the right conditions for a deeper awareness to appear. In the language of Zen philosophy, we understand Buddha nature as the ground of being and practice as the condition for realizing it. If you do what Katagiri says, relax your frontal lobe and open yourself to Zazen or whatever activity you're doing, you are accepting your place in the rhythm of life. Letting go and creating space for the next moment of creation is the same practice that the whole universe is doing. Opening yourself allows the energy of life into your awareness. You experience a sense of belonging to life or being part of something bigger than yourself. But the process doesn't end there. Realizing you belong to life changes the story you tell yourself about your life. And that new story guides you to seek further insight about how to take care of the surface and the depth of your everyday life for the benefit of yourself and others. So, now to the material in part two of the book. Most of what's here is commentary on the Shobo Genzo, written by Ehe Dogen. So I confess, for me, it's not all that easy. But first, a little about Dogen. He lived in the 13th century in Japan and ordained in the then dominant Tendai Buddhism when he was 13 years old. But he became philosophically dissatisfied with Tendai. So when he was 24, he made a pilgrimage to China, where he met Soto Zen teachers. And he then brought Soto Zen back to Japan and further developed it into what is sometimes called Dogen Zen. Katagiri felt a very deep connection to Dogen. For one thing, they shared the same birthday, January 19th, a mere 728 years apart. As a young monk, Katagiri spent 3 years training at Eheji, the monastery founded by Dogen, and studied with a teacher there who was very interested in Dogen. One of Katagiri's intentions was to teach Dogen Zen in a way that people like us could understand. But he knew that Dogen wasn't easy. I once heard him say something like, "Dogen's teachings are very interesting, but also very difficult. If I try to stay away from them, They're always pulling me back. I want to stop, but I can't stop. I can't escape from Dogen. Okay, so the three chapters in part two are 8 awarenesses of the enlightened person, let the flower of your life force bloom, and the spiritual mirror. The first one, 8 awarenesses of the enlightened person, is a synthesis I made of talks Katagiri gave during a 7-day sesshin on the Dogen's Hachi Daininggaku. That Japanese title is variously translated as 8 truths or precepts or realizations of a great person, or 8 aspects of awakening. It's Katagiri's commentary on Dogen's commentary on Buddha's 8 awarenesses of enlightenment, a final teaching of Buddha given while he was dying. Buddha's final teachings are found in the Mahayana Nirvana Sutra. Anything in that sutra may be considered a final teaching, but not necessarily Buddha's exact final words, which according to the Pali Canon were, "Things fall apart, tread the path with care." So 8 awarenesses was Buddha's final teaching, and Dogen's commentary on it was also his final teaching. He was suffering and knew that he was dying, so he struggled to write it in the cold of a very deep winter, and he died soon after. Dogen's successor, Ejo, wrote on the manuscript that this teaching is Shakyamuni Buddha's and Dogen Zenji's will for their descendants. So here is what Buddha and Dogen bequeathed to us. Having few desires, knowing how to be satisfied, enjoying serenity and tranquility, exerting precise effort, not forgetting mindfulness, practicing samadhi, practicing wisdom, avoiding idle talk. Buddha's final teaching bookends his first teaching, the Four Noble Truths, which, as you probably know, are first the truth of dukkha, understood as suffering, stress, or dissatisfaction. 2, suffering is caused by desire and aversion based on human self-centeredness. The end of dukkha is nirvana, freedom from selfish desires or realization of our true nature. And finally, there is the path of 8 practices that prepare us for that realization. Right effort, action, mindfulness, concentration, understanding, thought, speech, and livelihood. In Buddha's 8 awarenesses, the first 3, having few desires, knowing how to be satisfied, and enjoying serenity and tranquility, seem to express the rest and relief that come with freedom from dualistic mind. But then there are 5 that are active. And these 5 active ones contain almost the entire Eightfold Path. Right livelihood is the only one left out. But maybe that's because Buddha was talking to his followers, not people that had a job. So if our practices before and after enlightenment are the same, what's the deal here? Well, there's a kind of happily ever after mythology around enlightenment. Yes, enlightenment gives us insight into our Buddha nature, but it also gives us insight into our human nature. It makes all the bad habits we've accumulated more apparent to us. The bottom line is, if you have enlightened awareness, great. Enjoy the feeling of relief. But you still have work to do. And that work is pretty much the same work as you did before. But your point of view will be different. Practice in enlightenment, or practice in realization, are before and afterwards, but not in the way you might think. So when you hear the word practice, it can mean making an effort to learn a skill, but it can also mean making an effort to use that skill in a beneficial way. Practice is your effort to train your mind to learn the truth, and it is your effort to put that truth into your life. Practice as training matures into practice as life activity, in the sense of practicing medicine, which itself is an ongoing practice of continuously learning and developing your skill and capability. There's the same kind of before and after with the word realization. First, you realize something by grasping its meaning, and then you realize it in the sense of making it real by putting it into action. Feedback from action helps you deepen the meaning, etc. So practice and realization are endless for us. Sorry. Freedom or liberation as a goal also has two sides. Freedom from something like selfish desire becomes freedom to do something like practice right mindfulness. Before we move on to the next chapter, there's a story about Mahatma Gandhi that I'd like to share as an example of mindfulness in action. One day when he was a young man in India, Gandhi was waiting at the railway station to board a train. In those days, trains would only stop for white people. For others, trains would simply slow down enough for people to scramble on or off. Gandhi wasn't white, so the train slowed down and he scrambled on, but as he got on, his shoe came off. As he reached down to pick it up, it slid off the train and landed on the tracks. Without a moment of hesitation, Gandhi took off his other shoe and threw it on the tracks. Someone nearby wondered what the heck he was doing. So he pointed out that there was now a fine pair of shoes on the tracks for someone to find. In the first moment of losing a shoe like that, I think most people would get stuck, lamenting their loss, feeling sorry for themselves. How many of us would be flexible enough to turn the situation around and think of not wasting the life of two shoes or of benefiting someone who needed shoes? Well, I wish I could be mindful like that. The next chapter in part two is Let the Flower of Your Life Force Bloom. It's mostly composed of Katagiri Roshi's commentary on two related chapters of Dogen Shobo Genzo, Plum Blossoms, Baika in Japanese, and Flowers in the Sky, Kuge. Historically, these are almost Katagiri Roshi's final teachings. He was not well when he gave these talks in 1988, and perhaps he suspected how serious his illness really was, but we don't know that for sure. He was hospitalized in January 1989 and struggled with cancer for over a year before he died in 1990 at the age of 62. Both Flowers in the Sky and Plum Blossoms give us the image of the bright red five-petaled plum flower. The plum flower is a symbolic flower in Buddhism. It represents the pure sense of life energy. Japanese plum trees bloom in late December or early January before their leaves appear. At that time, the ground is covered with a blanket of white snow. Then all at once, all of a sudden, millions of plum blossoms suddenly open. It's a magnificent event. Life energy bursting forth from the snowy depth of emptiness and taking form. Dogen also uses the plum blossom as a symbol of the intimate relationship between oneness and individuality. The flower represents oneness. Its five petals represent differentiation. That's us. And both are Buddha. The flower doesn't exist as a flower without its five petals. And the petals don't exist without the flower. That's one of those Zen twists, like saying all in one and one in all. It's the totality. If we think of this as one of Katagiri's last teachings, what can we learn? Katagiri was very fond of quoting the statement that Shakyamuni Buddha gave when he awoke to reality. I and all sentient beings attain enlightenment simultaneously. Katagiri said this was pure oneness. No difference between all sentient beings and Buddha. He also said that the most important point in Buddha's teaching is to see ourselves and others in terms of oneness. Not making a dualistic distinction between yourself and others is the basis of the vow to save all beings. Dogen and Katagiri see the whole world in the blooming of one flower. Can we see the whole world in the blooming of ourselves? Or see it in each other? Can we understand our stressful lives as the blooming of Buddha, or politics as Buddha? How about accepting our delusions as Buddha? Dogen says, yes, delusions too are Buddha. Every aspect of everyday life is a magnificent event. Driving to work is a flower blooming. Changing a diaper is a magnificent event. Still, somehow, we have to figure out a way to live in the world as individuals, the petals, and make peace with the messy surface of everyday life. How do we live in a way that reconciles being separate and connected to the oneness of all life at the same time? Katagiri didn't offer any big answers to those questions, but he was always telling us to just go back to every single detail of everyday life and pay attention to it. See whatever it is as Buddha, and approach it as Buddha yourself. Handle others and yourself with wisdom and compassion. Take care of yourself, but don't attach to yourself too much. Do what life calls on you to do and don't gripe. Just be present. Now here's some seasonal plum blossom related trivia. Plum blossoms are one of three plants that are offered at shrines in Japan and in front of homes to celebrate the new year. The other two are bamboo stalks and pine branches. Bamboo represents patience because it isn't broken by the weight of snow. It bends and comes back up. Bamboo's segmented stalks also represent the differentiation of individuals existing within oneness, one stalk. So bamboo tells us to take care of individual people and things with patience. The pine tree never changes because it's evergreen, so it represents eternal existence. Putting these three plants together, we have pure life energy, individual existence, and the eternal existence of the universe. And maybe they also suggest a way we could turn our Christmas trees into Bodhi trees. The last chapter is Katagiri's commentary on Dogen's ancient mirror, Kokyo. It's from a weekend sesshin I attended in 1986. I started working on it for Each Moment is the Universe, but it didn't work out in there. But I couldn't let it go, so here it is. The intro material is from an older talk that includes a quote from a Yogacara scripture, the Madhyanta Vibhaga, which goes, Buddha takes away the curtain between object and mirror. So for this chapter, I want to say something about how I understand that mirror. Imagining a mirror is a way of talking about the true nature of mind as a basic awareness that's always with us. Anything that happens in that awareness is accepted freely, without hesitation, and reflected without judgment, just like a mirror. And not just images, but sounds, tastes, ideas, everything appears in that basic awareness. We can't see the mirror, we just see the reflections. And those reflections are an illusion because they're not the actual things themselves. But when those reflections are selectively picked up and used by our ego consciousness, that consciousness shows us the world in a concrete way. It sees me, my individual self, as the subject, and everything else as an object. In other words, it processes the reflections with a self-centered function. It's actually a good thing. We need a healthy ego to function in this world. We just have to keep it in perspective. Our human mind is always producing thoughts and ideas, and those ideas are reflected on the mirror. When ego picks up and uses those reflections, we can listen to ourselves think. We can carry on an inner conversation with ourselves. Who are we talking to? Sometimes I get really tired of listening to myself think. All those tediously repetitive, self-centered thoughts and worries. It takes real effort to turn our minds to a different channel, isn't it? But we're human beings, so that's a practice we're stuck with. But it can happen in spiritual practice that our ego consciousness stops moderating what we see. Our mind shifts, and we see our underlying mirror awareness, which is freely reflecting everything. I think that shift is the emergence of our Buddha nature from the veil of original ignorance that covered it up. without that sense of a me as a separate self that ego creates, we discover that we're within the whole array of interdependent co-origination. And the activity of that subtle energy becomes visible to us. If we can't distinguish between ourselves and everything else, then in a sense we are everything else. We feel intimate with the life around us and able to commune with trees, vegetables, anything that's reflected in that mirror with us. Katagiri mentions the way St. Francis of Assisi could talk with animals as an example of this communion, and I really loved that. When we realize that everything is already part of our life, there's nothing left to want. What a relief. That state of mind is the satisfaction of desire and relief from dukkha, which leads to having few desires and knowing how to be satisfied and enjoying serenity and tranquility. It also marks the beginning of a new understanding of what we need to do and a commitment to follow Buddha's path for the benefit of all beings. So that brings us back to where we started in this chapter, and I think it's a good place to stop. Thank you for listening to me. Do you have any questions or comments or thoughts on the book if you've been reading it that you want to share?
Andrea?
Yeah, Ken.
First, I would just like to thank you for these talks and for your work on the book. It's really wonderful. This connection to Katagiri is so important, and you're really bringing it alive here. And I think that's wonderful.
Oh, gosh, Jim. Thank you.
And my comment is not on the book, but rather, I can remember reading an article you wrote maybe a few years ago, and the title was something like Still Attending to Katagiri, and where I think you talked about how you were his attendant long ago and how you feel you're carrying that work forward. And I wonder if you could say a little bit about that.
So Ted asked me about still being an attendant to Katagiri Roshi. I would say that when you are an attendant to someone, your primary goal is to be really attentive to what would be useful to the person you're attending. And it's to put your own needs aside and to focus on that person's needs. And if I am still Katagiri's attendant, I am trying to see what would be useful to his legacy. He's not here anymore, but he's in my heart, and I guess I'm trying to take care of him.
He needs to keep writing books.
Let me ask a question about Katagiri as a Zen monk. How different was he from Suzuki Roshi, for example? In other words, are they all going to the same school and polishing the same stone? Or are these personal interests that really mature with insight?
Well, of course, it's both. But I think on the surface of their lives and their manifestation, I can't say exactly because I didn't know Suzuki Roshi, but on the internet, if you hunt, and it's not too hard to find, there's a thing on San Francisco Zen Center related website that David Chadwick maintains called Qk.com, and there's a page on there where Chadwick has extracted every time that Suzuki Roshi mentioned Katagiri Roshi. So you kind of get a sense of how of his perception of Katagiri, and he saw him as really different from himself. Katagiri was a lot more formal. I think he was devoted to Dogen. And he had mannerisms that were distinctly different from Suzuki's, as Suzuki expressed it.
When you say Suzuki Roshi, is that person and D.T. Suzuki, are those two different people?
They're different people, yeah. Yeah. D.T. Lived earlier than Suzuki and was the author, as you know, of many books. Shunryu Suzuki was a Japanese monk who came to San Francisco and started the San Francisco Zen Center.
So you tell about part by the first days, DT.
DT versus Shunryu, yeah.
It makes it real confusing for your librarian.
Actually, I had a very Buddhist history nerd question I posed to Ted earlier. DT Suzuki was teaching before Alan Watts.
People are nodding.
Okay. I know that's not the sort of detail that matters in the real learning, but some of us want to really geek out on Zen history.
I think it is interesting. If you do get into that about who was reading whom and who was being influenced, and there are subtle lines of thought in Zen philosophy that diverge in interesting ways that you can geek out all the way on that, you know, enjoy it.
Coming from the world my parents knew, I come to be amazed at what trailblazers D.T. Suzuki and Philip Kaplow were in the United States in the time
that worked. That's right. Three pillars of Zen.
Mm-hmm. It was a very radical work for
it. It influenced a lot of people practicing.
As was D.T. Suzuki. Mm-hmm. Tim told when he was younger, being at an event, and everybody like, D.T. Suzuki's going to be here, really? Mm-hmm. And that was a fond memory of Tim's from some time ago.
It's a wonderful quote. I read somewhere where someone asked Suzuki whether he was DT Suzuki or if they were related or something. And he said something like, no, he's big Suzuki, I'm little. Both funny and humble.
What that ties into is I've heard some of our priests use the expression big me and little me. Hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I came
by as well. Mm-hmm. Andrea, when you were talking about the eight aspects of enlightenment at the beginning of your talk, and there was mindfulness and then there was precision, and the first, you know, when you first said that, there was immediately this question in my mind about the difference between, you know, mindfulness and precision. And then I remember the story you told me, and I was just wondering if you might share this story, because I think it's a wonderful story about Katagiri. He was given a talk, starting to give a talk. You were his attendant, and he kept looking at you, wanting you to figure out if you needed something.
Right. And
you couldn't figure out what it was.
I was a bad attendant.
I think that was a really good demonstration of the difference between you were mindful.
I was
being demanding precision. Did you share that?
Oh, yeah, that's in that article that Ted mentioned about being his attendant. Yes, I was his attendant, and I was supposed to know what he needed, and he was somewhere like right here where I'm sitting right now, but he was kneeling down and facing the altar to do some chanting. So there was a chant card that was something that was in English and he hadn't memorized it or something, and he was holding it up in front of him, you know, kind of at arm's length so he could read from it. And then he started motioning to me, you know, shaking his head and looking at me to get my attention. And I'm like, what? Everything looks good to me. We're set to go. Well, it turned out he didn't have his glasses on. It just didn't occur to me. Finally, I think he got, you know, he was frustrated with me and he started, like, doing things to near his eyes to show me that it was his eyes that were the problem. And so, of course, suddenly then I realized it. I had to run upstairs to his office, and so everything stood still while Andrea's trying to figure out what Katagiri needs.
Thank you.
Deb, you have a question.
Well, I've been kind of trying to work on the concept of gratitude and how it ties in with Buddhism, but this really has this feeling of gratitude for our lives, you know, and how that seems to be a part of it.
Yeah, I think so. I think we're being given our lives every minute. We're receiving our lives as a gift of the universe.
Yeah.
Sometimes we wish we could send it back, but parts of it back, yeah. I'd like it this way, but maybe just not that way, please.
Yeah,
next time, could we do it a little differently? I love that you said that. That's really beautiful and something to come back to when things aren't looking so great for us. Yeah.
Question over here.
Hey, yeah.
Hey, I almost don't want to ask this question. when I first started coming to the Zen Center about 4 years ago, there was a talk given about Katagiri, and there was mentioned some inappropriate relations with the students. And I don't know much about it, but I started meditating at the London Buddhist Center, and the founder of that institution also had inappropriate relations.
Oh gosh.
With their students, so, but it didn't stop me from going there, and it hasn't stopped me from coming back here.
Mm-hmm.
But what is the teaching there?
Teaching is that that's a wrong thing to do. That's not acceptable. But maybe you were asking me, how do I deal with it? Maybe, yeah. At the time, we didn't know that it was going on. So we didn't, we couldn't deal with it with him while he was still alive. It came up as a shocking revelation after he died. And I don't know the full extent of it. I know who one of the women was because she talked about it. And I can't excuse what he did, but I feel in my heart it wasn't a predatory situation. But I don't really know. I know her, but I don't know. I've never talked to her about it. I heard there was another one that wasn't so good, you know, if you want to say good. And I don't really know the whole story, but it is on the internet. I for some reason, personally, had never idealized Katagiri Roshi. I accepted him as a human being. I didn't put him on a pedestal in the first place. People who did had a harder time with it, I think, because they had wanted to think there was some kind of ideal person in this world, and that maybe they too could be an ideal person and not the deluded, messy person that they were right now. And it turned out that he wasn't that person. He was a deluded, messy person too. And I feel sorry for everyone that he let down. He let me down. He let everyone down. And I'm sorry. I'm really sorry that he did that. I'm sorry for him that he was so messed up himself that that's what he came to do. There just must have been something very difficult in his life there. And sometimes I look at his whole life story, and I have because I've written his biography, and I can see how hard his life was, and I have compassion for him. So I try to understand that he was a flawed person, and that despite the fact that he was flawed, he did a lot of good for me and many, many, many other people. So I just accept both. And I love him. You know, he's in my heart.